Burnings in Afghanistan last week are reported to be nearly complete. An official with the U.S.-led International Security Assistance Force says the probe will offer a broad conclusion into the circumstances that led U.S. troops at Bagram Air Base to destroy the Islamic holy books. President Obama said the burnings were unintentional and apologized to the Afghan people, but the incident continues to fuel protests and Taliban calls for attacks on Westerners. A search is underway for three people who were on board a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter when it crashed on Alabama's Gulf Coast last night. Authorities say a fourth crew member has died. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 42 points at 12,963, NASDAQ gaining 3 at 2,990. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese.
Nick Flynn was working at a homeless shelter when his father, an alcoholic and self-proclaimed writer Flynn never knew as a child, showed up as a client. Flynn wrote about it in his 2004 memoir. Now it's a film starring Robert De Niro as Flynn's father, directed by Paul Weitz, who also directed About a Boy. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nick Flynn and Paul Weitz. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, three blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House Catering can tailor a menu and price for events from corporate box lunches to weddings, business meetings, and other special events. More information is available at 365-8004.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. This hour, Focus, comes to you from the archives. This is a program that we first broadcast last November. So in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. It's been estimated that last year, 2010, governments around the world spent $1.6 trillion on weapons. That is $235 for every person on the planet. Anti-corruption activist Andrew Feinstein says that this spending has profound impacts on the world. It fuels conflict. It erodes democracy in both buying and selling countries and siphons off money that might otherwise be channeled into development. In this hour of Focus, we will explore both the formal and the gray markets of the global arms trade, the subject of Andrew Feinstein's recently published book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. That's the subtitle. Furrah, Strauss, and Giroux is the publisher. Our guest, Andrew Feinstein, is author of After the Party, a political memoir about his experiences being involved in the politics of South Africa. He currently is an Open Society Institute Fellow, and he is the founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London, where he makes his home. He's now spending some time in the United States, traveling around talking about the arms trade, and we're very pleased that he could spend some time with us on this program. And Mr. Feinstein, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good. I much appreciate you giving us some of your time. We can toss around a lot of numbers here, and certainly we talk about these big dollar amounts.
Yeah.
But I guess something that I think is really striking and goes right to the issue of corruption, even though we are talking about a lot of money, in grand terms, it's not enormous, really. And yet, when you look at the estimates that have been made about how much of that involves corruption and how much of the, if you look at world trade and ask, okay, how much of global world trade is there corruption?
Yeah.
And then what part of that is the arms trade, then that number really looms very large.
Absolutely. Work by a guy called Joe Rober, who was with an organization called Transparency International at the time, estimates that of all global trade and all corruption in global trade, the arms industry, which, as you say, in quantitative terms, isn't that big, but it accounts for almost 40% of all of that corruption, which is a truly startling number. And I think that is the point at which the impact of this industry on the world, on the nature of our democracies, on the sorts of political choices that we make, and on ordinary people's lives really starts to gain significance.
Mm. And what I think what's really striking, and perhaps this provides some answer to the question, why is there this level of corruption? That it's certainly, even if you're talking about government to government deals, there is serious need of transparency, and it's something where a small number of people are really involved on both sides, and in the buying country, it could be definitely a very small number of people making the decisions. So there certainly is the opportunity for a great deal of corruption to take place, just because of the way that the business is structured.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I would argue that it is in the DNA of the way that the industry is structured that corruption is almost inevitable. You really have three types of deals. You have, as you mentioned, the formal government-to-government deals, which is seen as the clean trade. You then have the gray market, which has elements of illegality in it and is often used by countries to try and influence foreign policy, but covertly. And then you have the black market, which are arms deals that are both illegal in conception and execution. And unfortunately, what has been happening over a period of decades now is that those three markets have become heavily intertwined. And so you see the impact in a deal when you have, you know, because the point about the industry is you only have two or three really big deals a year, and they're worth tens of billions of dollars. So they're obviously crucial to weapons manufacturers to try and win these deals. And because of their size, because of, as you mentioned, the very small number of decision makers, it is ripe for bribery and corruption. Now, the greatest difficulty, though, is that all of this happens behind a veil of secrecy. And this is obviously imposed by national security requirements. And in many arms deals, a significant component of the information is appropriately kept secret. However, my argument is that a lot of what is nothing more than criminal conduct is also being hidden behind this veil of national security. And that information does not impinge on national security. It is used to protect the individuals, often the political parties, who are involved in the corrupt components of the transaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps as an example, I could ask you to talk about some of your experiences when you were a member of the South African Parliament, when you were involved in trying to investigate this a very large arms deal between a very large British arms dealer and the government of South Africa.
Correct. I was very fortunate. I grew up in South Africa, and I joined the African National Congress, the party of Nelson Mandela, in my late teens when it was still a banned organization during the apartheid years in South Africa. And when democracy eventually came to the country in 1994, I was very fortunate to be elected an ANC member of parliament. I was the ranking ANC member on the main financial oversight committee, and we received a report of a $10 billion arms deal, although the government claimed it was costing far less than that. And our auditor general, a bit like the inspector general here, was very concerned that this deal and the procurement criteria that had been used to select the winners had been profoundly undermined. And myself and the chairperson of the committee investigated this further, and what we discovered was a litany of abuse and corruption. The specific contract you refer to was for jet trainer and fighter planes, so highly sophisticated, incredibly expensive equipment. And the bid was made by a joint British company, BAE Systems, and a Swedish arms manufacturer, Saab. And initially, out of nine bids, their bid had not made a shortlist because it didn't meet the technical specifications required, and it was 2.5 times more expensive than the plane that the South African Air Force actually wanted. However, the Minister of Defense at the time, an ANC-appointed minister, completely undermined the procurement criteria. He decided on the biggest single contract that South Africa has ever signed since the end of apartheid to exclude cost as a procurement criteria. That still didn't put the British-Swedish bid in top place. So he then manipulated another one of the criteria, something called economic offsets, which as an economist I regard as so much economic sophistry. And in this way, pushed the British Swedish bid into first place. So they won the contracts. We then discovered that 115 million British pounds of bribes had been paid to at least three of the people involved in the decision-making process on that particular contract, and to my political party, the ANC itself. And it is worth just bearing in mind, this was at the time, this is late 1998, early 1999, that Nelson Mandela's successor, Thabo Mbeki, was telling South Africa that we did not have the money to be able to provide antiretroviral medication to the over 5 million South Africans then living with HIV and AIDS. And so my committee tried to investigate the deal. We had done this under Mandela. We were a non-party political committee. We didn't vote. We reached agreement by consensus. We didn't deal with matters of policy, but only financial regularity and irregularity. And as soon as we tried to start investigating, I was told by emissaries of the president to stop the investigation, that it would be investigated privately within the party, not publicly in Parliament. And I objected, to cut a long story short, and because of the very strange constitutional system we have in South Africa, I was then removed first from the committee, and when I continued to raise questions about this deal from Parliament. And then I continued to investigate the deal and produced my first book on the deal and its impact on South African democracy, which has frankly been tragic. We have seen a Harvard study school, Kennedy School of Government study, estimate conservatively that 355,000 South Africans died avoidable deaths in the 5.5 years after that arms deal because they could not access life-saving medication through the public health system. But we could spend $10 billion on this arms deal. We discovered that our 1999 election campaign had been financed by the bribes paid by these companies. Two of the anti-corruption bodies that tried to investigate were closed down. This committee, this oversight committee in Parliament, has become nothing more than a rubber stamp to the dominant party, which remains the ANC. And even the prosecutorial authorities, which are also supposed to be constitutionally independent, have been profoundly undermined by the efforts to conceal the corruption in the deal. And South Africa's current president, Jacob Zuma, was facing 783 counts of corruption in relation to this arms deal. These charges of corruption were dropped 10 days before he was elected the country's president 2 years ago. And 3 weeks after the election, the Attorney General, who dropped the charges against him, was made a High Court judge in South Africa. So its impacts have been profound on South Africa's democracy and on the life of ordinary South Africans.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus, Andrew Feinstein. He's the author of the book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's recently come out. He makes his home in London. He is a founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London. He is now spending some time in the United States to talk about the shadow world and about the arms trade. And questions certainly are welcome. We have a couple of people here we'll get right to, and we'd welcome others. Just hope people, again, can be brief in their comments, just so that we can get in as many as possible, but certainly calls are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The first caller we have here is in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was curious, since the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact is no more, was there some kind of effort made to control the immense amount of weapons that suddenly became available that were meant to be used in a large global war, if necessary, but now suddenly that isn't necessary? So all of these weapons, including nuclear weapons, are conceivably available on the underground. Did they ever try and prevent this?
That's a very good question. Part of the difficulty in the global trade in arms, and particularly in the black market, is that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was an enormous amount of weaponry, as the caller says, that was stockpiled all over the former Soviet Union. The Ukraine was really the Soviet Union's weapons factory, so there was a lot concentrated there. But in countries that today, Belarus and a variety of others, have huge stockpiles. Those, a massive amount of those weapons came onto the black market during the transitional period as the Cold War ended, and have really fueled conflicts around the world, especially conflicts across the African continent, the conflicts in the Balkans, some conflicts in South and Latin America, and even in South Asia, have been fueled by those Soviet weapons historically.
Yes, and I know now that they're trying to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of some of our rogue states. Do you know, I've heard rumors that Israel is considering attacking Iran to keep them from getting nuclear weapons. And, of course, we've been wondering about North Korea. Did they benefit from any of these sales?
Well, I think what you do find is so-called rogue nations. So rogue nations who, those nations that are not well-liked by Western powers in particular, and that don't often play by the rules that have been set out internationally, were a magnet for these sorts of weapons. In my book, I've dealt almost exclusively with conventional weapons, because this is an area that just hasn't been researched for decades now. But there is no doubt that a lot of the same practices and processes were happening in relation to nuclear weapons and nuclear material. And that had started even before the end of the Cold War. Israel and South Africa before 1994 were, for instance, engaged in working together on the development of nuclear weapons. Countries that you mentioned, like North Korea and Iran, made hay out of the conventional weapons that were available after the Cold War, but also started to procure certainly components of nuclear weapons. And yes, speculation is at the moment that there might be an attack on Iran. And I think that that, to a large extent, also reflects some of what we call blowback or the unintended consequences of the arms trade, because it is worth recalling that in the 1980s there was, of course, the big Iran-Contra scandal, where the United States and Israel, with a lot of money from Saudi Arabia, actually landed up arming with quite sophisticated weaponry the Iranian regime that at that time was led by Ayatollah Khomeini. So unfortunately, what happens is that the weaponry and sometimes even nuclear components lands up in the hands of people you're not quite expecting to be the end users of these weapons. They're incredibly difficult to control. And unfortunately, while there are a number of measures in place globally, those measures haven't worked particularly effectively.
Thank you, gentlemen.
No.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, we'll go on to another caller here in Thomasboro. This is line one.
Well, good morning. Another incredible conversation. Perfect question and answer to lead in the next part. I was personally involved in everything, and I'm wondering if the author is familiar with the 3rd U.S. Army Captured Equipment Project. And this was a project we did under General John A. Guest at the end of Desert Storm, where we redistributed all of the Iraqi Soviet weapons all over the world. I mean, Lebanon, Africa, Afghanistan, you name it, Mexico. And now they're obviously being reused on us. We did try to send teams in to get them before we started all this stuff unsuccessfully. And I was just wondering if the author is directly, you know, aware of that huge project that continues on to this day, because we're just sending a whole bunch into Palestine.
Absolutely. It really is tragic. You know, I can quite literally... I could go to an open-air arms market in Mogadishu and in Somalia, and I could buy some of those weapons for very, very little money. And even more worrying than that is we are seeing a situation post the Arab Spring, where the U.S. has been distributing a lot of weaponry into Egypt, together with European countries into Libya.
Libya, absolutely. We sent stuff in Libya.
Absolutely. And a lot of those weapons, I've noted in the last few months that those weapons have already started appearing on the black markets of the world. So, for instance, and this would be very familiar to you, caller, surface-to-air missiles, which are not only militarily dangerous, but also have the ability to bring down commercial aircraft, have been found on the black markets, weapons markets, on the peripheries of Egypt. And it's assumed that those were sourced from Colonel Gaddafi's stockpiles in Libya. So this is definitely one of the fundamental parts of the problem, is that because there has been, post the Cold War, and especially post the terrorist attacks of 9/11 in the United States, there has been a quite militaristic approach to foreign policy, not just from America, but from a lot of other countries as well. This has led to the dispersal of weapons around the world, and these arms dealers, these middlemen, sometimes called brokers, ensure that they put together these weapons that are available with people who want to get their hands on these weapons. And as you rightly point out, these are often not the people we want to have this sort of weaponry.
Not at all. Hey, David, could you share the information I sent with him, please?
I can't. You mean you sent it to me?
Yeah, I sent it on email. Just send it to him and share it with him so we can contact. Great. Thank you.
Right.
Excellent. Superb. Right on the money. Doesn't get any better than this.
Well, I thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll talk next with somebody in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, a caller there? Yes, go ahead.
There is no transaction between military drug bank transaction without assistance, without approval of Washington, London, Tel Aviv, Paris, the countries who possess nuclear weapons and the countries who actually spend more than anybody else. The United States spends more than the entire world on military, and of course the used or unnecessary weapons, they sell it on both sides. Without CIA, Mossad, M16, nothing in this world can be done. And why you're surprised that some of the weapons will end up in wrong hands and used against American military, where our military, instead of protecting the borders, what the Constitution says, is in 170 countries protecting the big business and the big money and the banks.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to jump in here on the caller because the quality of the line is quite poor. But I think, though, his point, I wonder if, Mr. Feinstein, you could address at least one aspect of his point, and that is the degree to which governments are part of this trade.
They absolutely are. I've followed a number of arms dealers who I would regard as operating in the shadow world, the black and gray markets, and often without exception, they have done work for the larger governments in the world. So to give you an example, I tracked down an arms dealer based in Beirut of Lebanese-Armenian extraction who has been operating in the shadow world of arms trade for almost four decades now. He's now a gentleman in his late 70s. And after telling me about this work that he's been involved in, selling into breaking UN embargoes in the Balkans, selling into conflicts in the Middle East, into Africa, he very proudly pulled out his contractor ID for the department, the U.S. Department of Defense in Iraq and Afghanistan, for one or two very large U.S. defense contractors in those countries, and also his contractor ID for U.S. AID in Liberia. Now, he argues at the moment that because the United States so dominates the weapons market, one of your callers was quite correct, the U.S. spends on and produces almost as much weaponry as the rest of the world combined. So this gentleman said to me at the end of our interview that in the current market, you cannot operate as an arms dealer unless you have access to American weaponry. In addition to which, in the case that I mentioned earlier of South Africa that I was involved in trying to investigate, the British government was extremely actively involved in selling this deal to South Africa, knowing that the equipment was inappropriate, that it was completely overpriced, South Africa paid a premium of 35%, and that corruption was taking place. If someone like myself, a rather innocuous member of parliament, can find out about the sort of corruption that was going on, I do think that, that in the upper reaches of the British government, they had to have been aware of the sort of behavior that was underpinning this negotiation and this contract. So at a whole range of levels, governments are deeply, deeply involved in the arms trade, but not only in the formal and legal trade. They definitely are involved in what I've described as the shadow world. And one of the main ways this happens is that they use a lot of these arms dealers, brokers, middlemen, as sources for intelligence, as intelligence assets. There are very few arms dealers around the world who have not been used in this way. And this is why the sorts of contradictions start arising. We've seen recently, just in the last weeks, the Russian arms dealer Viktor Boot was convicted of arms trafficking in a New York courthouse. And the reality is that between 2003 and 2005, while there was an international warrant for Mr. Boot's arrest, he was being used by the U.S. government to transport equipment and ammunition and weaponry into Iraq, which was very difficult to get into during those stages. Mr. Boot, in that period of about 3 years, made about $60 million from the work that he was doing for the U.S. government while there was an international warrant for his arrest. So unfortunately, the trade also reflects a lot of the hypocrisy and double dealing that exists in the global political process at the moment.
Just I hate to pick again on the UK government, but it just as another example of a case where there was corruption, and it would seem that either the government knew or the government should have known. I'm thinking here of what's said to be the biggest arms deal in history, once again involving that same company, BAE Systems. And in this case, it was Saudi Arabia. And here we're not just talking about here millions in commissions. We're talking about billions in commissions. It's just here, it's really quite staggering when the amount of money we're talking about.
Absolutely. We're talking about a situation of what is equivalent probably to $10 billion. Having been paid in commissions, and commissions are of two types in this industry. One is a legitimate commission to an agent or a company that is doing some work for you, be it marketing or whatever. The other are what are called unauthorized commissions, which are effectively bribes. And the British Metropolitan Police have identified that figure of $10 billion in commissions on the deal known as the Al-Yamamah deal between the United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia. I mean, one of the people who received commissions was even the son of the former British Prime Minister at the time of the deal, Margaret Thatcher. Mark Thatcher was paid £12 million as an agent on that deal, which his mother had negotiated. And what happened with that deal, which is both the largest arms deal in history and also widely regarded as the most corrupt transaction in history, is that the UK's Serious Fraud Office, a little like the Department of Justice here, investigated that deal for about 5 years and was on the verge of bringing charges against executives from BAE Systems, the British company. And the government of Tony Blair intervened to close down that investigation, as the Saudis had said that if the investigation continued, they would, one, not purchase the 70 Typhoon aircraft they were on the verge of buying from Great Britain, and second, they would withdraw intelligence cooperation between their two countries. And on that basis, then Prime Minister Tony Blair ordered the closure of that investigation. The South African investigation that I mentioned to you was being investigated together with four or five other deals in which there were allegations of widespread and substantial corruption, all involving the same company, BAE Systems. the UK's Serious Fraud Office settled with the company BAE Systems for an amount of £500,000, half a million pounds, with a fine of a reparation cost of £29 million that had to be paid to one of the governments involved, the government of Tanzania in Africa. And, you know, this was a fraction of what the company had made on those five deals. So there is no incentive for the company to necessarily change its ways. And unfortunately, in this particular case, there was consistent behavior of an unethical and illegal type by this company, and it effectively got off with a light tap on the wrist.
In this hour of focus, we are talking with Andrew Feinstein. He is the author of a political memoir, After the Party, about some of his experiences in politics in South Africa. Currently, he's an Open Society Institute fellow, is the founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London, and is now spending some time in the United States to talk about this issue of the global arms trade, something that he has written about in his recently published book, The Shadow World, and it is published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux. Something that I want to come back to, you were talking a little bit earlier at the beginning about the deal between BAE and systems and the government of South Africa. Something else in addition to paying commissions or bribes that these companies can do is apparently they can say to the government, they say, now, look, if you will buy these weapons from us, what we will do is make the promise that for every dollar you spend with us to buy weaponry, we will invest a dollar, dollar and a half, $2 in your economy in another way, which ends up being, you know, another kind of incentive. But what I understand is the case, though, is if you were a company selling something else,
yes,
other than weapons, you couldn't do that.
Absolutely correct. The World Trade Organization has banned the use of these are called economic offsets, sometimes industrial offsets. And the World Trade Organization has banned their use in any procurement decision. So when a government is deciding who to buy something it needs from, it cannot consider any of these offsets that are offered by the selling country or company in making its buying decision, except in the weapons trade. And I have been unable to establish why there is this exception for the defense trade, because what happens with these offsets is two things. They are used as a justification by politicians for spending enormous amounts of money on weaponry, often that isn't used or that is far too sophisticated for what is actually required. And secondly, they very, very seldom actually deliver on what is promised. So in the South African case that I mentioned earlier, the South African government, a very new government in a young democracy, was promised the earth. Less than half of the number of jobs that were promised have actually come to fruition. And the way in which the weapons manufacturers have been rewarded with offset credits or credits for their investments has been almost laughable. To give you just one example, I mentioned that Saab were involved in the big deal to sell jet fighters. Saab invested a very small amount of money, probably equivalent to just under $3 million, in a little tourism venture in the eastern part of South Africa, in a fairly remote area. They were given credit, according to their offset obligations, for every single Swedish citizen who visited South Africa for 5 years after they made this investment, whether they went to the region of the country where they made their investment, whether they actually went to the tourism sites that they had invested in. So in 2010, South Africa was hosting the Soccer World Cup. And for every Swedish visitor who went to watch the soccer in South Africa during the World Cup, Sweden was awarded offset credits. So they really are. They are something of a a further veil of secrecy, a further blanket to hide what is going on behind the scenes, because they are also very useful in passing on what you and I understand as bribes. Mm-hmm. The South African defense minister at the time of this deal was bought shares in a company of which he became chairman the day after he left government. That company benefited to the tune of tens of millions of dollars in these offset arrangements from BAE Systems, the company that he had decided would be awarded a contract to supply the fighter aircraft. And so this, to him, was a massive reward for manipulating the procurement criteria in favor of this company, who could then pay him through this offset mechanism. So one of the things that I would certainly like to see change is that the World Trade Organization would similarly outlaw the use of these economic offsets in defense procurement decisions.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems that one of the aspects of this that makes it difficult to investigate is that the three markets, the quote-unquote clean trade, the gray and the black, are all tangled up together, and that, in fact, as you write about in the book, there are arms dealers and agents who may provide services to governments, to large producers, who are also involved in the gray and the black markets. And here's where, maybe I'll have you tell a story that does somehow, we were sort of picking on the government of the UK, that touches on the US government. I'm thinking about the case of the man who was awarded a multi-million dollar contract to provide ammunition to the security forces in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Here we have a situation that shows fundamental problems with the US procurement system, but also the wider ramifications of problems with the system. Early in the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan, there was a need to provide the Afghan security forces with ammunition for their weaponry. A lot of that weaponry, for reasons that one of our callers earlier mentioned, the availability of weaponry after the Cold War, the Afghans were using a huge number of Soviet weaponry, and also obviously because a lot of Soviet weaponry was left in the country after the Soviet Union was forced out of Afghanistan. So there was a need to find ammunition, which is not that easy to do on the open market. The U.S. Department of Defense decided to award a $300 million contract to a 21-year-old gentleman from Miami Beach, Florida, who was already at that age on a State Department arms trading watch list. But the Department of Defense admits that it didn't consult that watch list. In addition to which, when the Department of Defense had due diligence carried out on this young gentleman, the due diligence was undertaken by somebody who actually had a financial interest in the 21-year-old arms dealing company. And he was awarded the contract, $300 million. Being clearly a pretty intelligent guy, he identified that one of the places in the world he would get this ammunition, probably more cheaply than anywhere else, was in Albania, in Eastern Europe. Albania had, for 40 years, been a very isolated country, but had a highly, highly paranoid communist leader who had stockpiled weapons and ammunition both from China and of their own manufacture. So Ephraim Diveroli, the 21-year-old at the time, went off to Albania, did a deal with some businessmen who lurk on the edges of organized crime networks in Eastern Europe, as well as the defense minister of Albania at the time. It was arranged that the Albanian army would gather up all of these stockpiles of ammunition and take them to a very rudimentary prefabricated factory that was established between the capital of Albania, Tirana, and the international airport about half an hour outside the city. And in this factory, they decommissioned some of the worst of the ammunition that couldn't be used. They cleaned, quite literally washed, and filed off any made-in-China insignia on the rest of the ammunition, repackaged it as it was in very moldy 40-year-old packaging, and sent it off to Afghanistan. Now, what happened in Afghanistan is that as the U.S. trainers tried to demonstrate with this ammunition, there were a whole lot of little accidents with handguns exploding and various other things, and a number of fortunately minor incidents of injury. But a far greater impact was that as the factory got busier and busier, they were quite literally just bulldozing the empty shells, the TNT, the gunpowder that had come out of the decommissioned equipment and some of the equipment they decided not to send to Afghanistan. They were bulldozing it into a nearby field. And 3 years ago, in March 2008, the factory exploded. It destroyed 350 houses in the village and killed 26 innocent people, including a 3.5-month-old baby, a 7-year-old boy, and three generations of the family whose house was closest to the factory, who very sadly happened to be at home at the time of the explosion.
Hmm. And after all of that, this man, Ephraim Dvoroli, he ended up getting only a very light sentence. I don't think he even had to repay the money that he had been paid to supply this bad stuff.
He was eventually sentenced to 4 years in jail for trading in Chinese ammunition. While he was awaiting sentencing on that first conviction, he was again arrested for illegal arms dealing. And as he was being bundled into the police car, he made the comment that once one is a gun runner, one is always a gun runner. But most remarkable of all, he didn't have to pay back the money that he had already been paid out on this contract. So when he emerges from jail, all of those assets worth around, I believe, $10 million will still be his. So I can see absolutely no incentive for this man, when he comes out of jail in the United States, to do anything but go straight back into the arms trade. And meanwhile, nobody has faced justice for the deaths of 26 people in the small village on the outskirts of Tirana in Albania.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Andrew Feinstein. His book is The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. He's the founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London, and he is spending some time in the United States to talk about the book. We have about 10 minutes, maybe 7, 8 minutes left in this part of focus. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I would imagine that some of the arms manufacturers and perhaps some of the people in the countries where they're located would argue against tighter regulation by trying to make the claim that these industries were very important to the economies of the countries where they are based. So one would say, well, to the UK, it makes an important contribution to the economy, or to the US.
Yes.
Is that in fact true? If you take a look at, for example, BAE Systems and what it contributes to the economy of the UK, is it significant?
Well, it's very difficult to judge because the figures of employment put out by these companies are not particularly reliable. So at one point, for instance, when the Saudi Arabians were threatening not to buy the Typhoon jets if an investigation into BAE and an arms deal with them went ahead, BAE claimed that 55,000 jobs in the United Kingdom would be in peril. Closer investigation by a university in the United Kingdom revealed that, in fact, between 5 and 10,000 of those jobs were actually in the United Kingdom. The rest of them had all been moved to other parts of the world, particularly Central and Eastern Europe. So, again, because of the veil of secrecy around this industry, to get to actual figures is very difficult, and this allows the companies to significantly bloat the figures of employment. There is no doubt in the United Kingdom case that BAE Systems is an important part of British manufacturing, an industrial sector that has been in steep decline for decades now. But the reality is that contribution comes at a cost. And the cost are public subsidies through various mechanisms: the subsidization of research and development costs, the involvement of a whole range of government departments in promoting the work of these companies, particularly in the arms sector where government plays such a crucial role. And there are even subsidization of certain posts within these companies. So in the United States, where, yes, defense contractors are significant employers, it has been calculated that for similar amount of investments in the type of jobs that we find in the large defense contractors in the United States, up to 7 equivalent jobs could be created in other manufacturing sectors in the U.S. So, yes, the sector creates jobs, but those jobs are extremely expensive, and they do have a public cost.
All right. Let's talk with another caller. It's here in Champaign County, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I wasn't able to listen earlier, and maybe this question has been asked. How much do you put to, like, knowing connivance on the manufacturer's part in diverting stuff to the black market because of the higher return? A lot of times they say they were diverted in by being stolen, like the analogy to the clandestine or illicit drugs, but pharmaceutical drugs, but... But maybe you've already treated that. The other thing was, I remember this story about all these unregistered weaponry that went into Iraq under Petraeus. And it seems to me that I also remember that they were supposed to have been diverted from out of the Balkans, where they were part of the clandestine support for the KLA. So it was a way of, you know, like burning the evidence by dumping them into Iraq in an undocumented way, and
yes.
It seems like it's a whole other dimension when the Pentagon itself was using the Russian guy to supply stuff into Iraq, and now he's being tried. But so that there's both instances are of regular institutions using the clandestine trade in a certain way, their own ends, justifying the means, as it were. So I'll hang on and listen, since my radio is not functioning right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are two dimensions to the question that I'll address. The first is the sorts of costs that are caused. It's estimated that the costs of a lot of arms deals are increased by between 35% and 50% because of the role of corruption. What often happens in these deals is that the costs of the commissions, as well as, for instance, where there are any economic offsets, the costs of any potential penalties are simply brought into the are built into the purchase price. So in the South African case, we paid on average a 35 to 40% premium on the arms deal I was speaking about earlier. But the other dimension that needs to be remembered in relation to that is that the value of the weapons that are manufactured, when they come out of the big manufacturers, be it a Lockheed Martin or BAE Systems in the UK, their value, their starting value is increased by virtue of the existence of the black market, because it is known by both seller and buyer at that initial stage that this weapon will have a far longer life than just its first buyer. Because what happens in the grey and black markets, quite obviously, as the caller mentioned, is that this weaponry continues to circulate and to circulate and often has a life of a number of decades. I mean, there are many weapons that are still in use that have been around for 30, 40 years. So that, without a doubt, increases the initial value and hence the interrelationships between the formal trade and the black and gray markets. Then on the question of illicit weapons into Iraq and Afghanistan, there were two stories in relation to that. One was, yes, from the Balkans, there were a lot of allegations that weapons through people who traded in the illicit market and who broke the UN arms embargo in the Balkans, including the Lebanese-Armenian dealer I was talking about earlier, who made a lot of money out of getting weapons into the Balkans, that yes, some of that weaponry has certainly landed up in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it covers the tracks both of what happened in the Balkans and some of what is happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I should just mention at this point that I've tried with a law professor at a university in British Columbia in Canada to assess the impact of UN arms embargoes, and we've identified 502 violations of UN arms embargoes. One of those violations ever resulted in a criminal trial, and the people involved were acquitted at that trial, just to give you some sense of the lack of rigorous policing of this issue. Mm-hmm. Then the second example of weapons landing up in Iraq and Afghanistan relates to the quite famous Beretta company in Italy, where a vast shipment was made from the Beretta factory itself into Iraq, but for some reason the weapons were not registered as arriving in Iraq for almost a year after they were transported, and nobody quite knows what happened to them, except to say that a number of those same weapons landed up in the hands of insurgents who were captured in Iraq. And perhaps that more than anything typifies the very real dangers that exist in the global trade in arms and that desperately need to be cleaned up.
Hmm. We're at the point here where we must finish, and my apologies, I have a caller we can't take. We simply don't have time. But if and I can offer you only about a minute to talk about what you think should be done to address this problem.
I think very quickly that the most important thing that can take place is far greater transparency. Strong international anti-corruption measures relating to the arms trade, and there is an international arms trade treaty being negotiated in the UN at the moment. And finally, far greater enforcement and heavier penalties, both for the illicit dealers, but also for the large corporations and even governments who operate in the illicit world.
All right. The book, if you'd like to read it, is The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade by our guest, Andrew Feinstein. The book is published by Ferris Strauss Giroux. Andrew Feinstein is founding co-director of Corruption Watch in London. Mr. Feinstein, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for your time.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show that we first broadcast last November, on November 7th. Many programs are available as part of our web archive, so you can go back and listen to some you might have missed. That way you can also check the schedule and find out about upcoming shows. That's all at WILL.illinois.edu. Tomorrow morning on the show, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Eric Swingedal. He is a geographer from the University of Manchester in the UK, and will be on the campus to give a talk in the MillerCom series. He's interested in global urbanization, and his main argument, he says, is that today, even though not everyone lives in cities, we all live in an urbanized world. And he's very interested in the way that cities bring together social, political, economic, and cultural conditions that all shape our lives. He says the city is a great laboratory, and it makes it possible for him to make sense of the world. So we'll talk about how things like money, capital, nature, environment, social power all come together in cities and how that has manifested in political action in cities in recent years, various places around the world. I think he has some interesting things to say. And so he'll be with us in studio tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. Then at 11, we'll do our monthly computer show, the show we call Computers and You. Celeste Quinn will be the host for that program. And her guests will be Deborah Fleiger and Jim Eyrick. Deb Fleiger works at Site, Campus Information Technologies and Education Services on the U of I campus. Jim is with the National Center for Supercomputing Application, and this is an opportunity for you to call in and ask questions, and they can troubleshoot. If you're having some difficulty with your computer, it's just not doing what you want it to do, you can call in and talk about it with them. That's tomorrow morning at 11. Again, we're here weekday mornings 10 to noon. You can get the schedule at will.illinois.edu.
This fall, visit England and Wales, locations made famous in Last of the Summer Wine, Downton Abbey, and more, including Agatha Christie's home on the coast of South Devon. Does American history suit you? Well, travel in private vintage train cars on our Civil War train. This September's itinerary includes important southern battlefields and discussions with historian Anthony Pitch. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300.
WILL programs are made possible with support from Art Mart in Lincoln Square, Urbana. Art Mart's deli, grocery, and bakery feature premium foods and ingredients for cooking and entertaining, including Newhouse chocolates from Belgium. Art Mart is pleased to support public radio.
That's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media. WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. It's time for our look at the commodities, and we go to Kansas City first. March wheat trading there, down one half at 699. The May contract, 709.5, down one half. March wheat in Chicago, 664, up 1¾. May, down 1¾ at 666.5. March corn, 656, up 2½. May, 658.25, up 1. July, 660.25, up 1½. September, 598.5, up 2¾. March soybeans, 1313, up 7¾. May, 1319.5, up 7. July, 1327.5, up